Chapter 28 Ecology and World Prehistory. The skipper of the English trawler Kalinda cursed when his nets brought up a lump of peat from the North Sea's Leman and Ower banks in 1931. But as his crew bent down to throw the dark mass overboard, the peat split open. A brown, barbed object fell out onto the deck, some peat still clinging to it. The skipper was intrigued, and, fortunately for science, he brought the find back to port. Eventually, it reached Norwich Museum, where experts identified it as a classic bone harpoon of a type made by Stone Age hunters in Scandinavia. It was exhibited at a meeting of the Prehistoric Society of East Anglia in 1932. Among those in the audience was a young archaeologist from Cambridge named John Graham Douglas Clark, 1907 to 95. As a teenager at Marlborough College, Clark had been nicknamed Stones and Bones for his fascination with stone tools and animal bones. His first exposure to archaeology was in the narrow world of flint tool collecting. Most archaeology was still in the hands of amateurs who hunted quarries and river gravel exposures looking for stone tools and pottery. These were people with limited interests, but Clark learned a great deal by associating with them. The world of archaeology was still focused on local sites. Only a few scholars, like Gordon Child, had a broader vision. Child thought of the European past as a form of history in which artifacts, rather than people, were the main players. Clark found this far more interesting than merely describing stone tools. In the 1920s, Cambridge University did not offer a 3-year degree course in archaeology alone. And so when Clark went there in 1926, he spent his first 2 years studying history, an invaluable experience, for it exposed him to some remarkable scholars, among them world historian George Trevelyan. Economic historian Michael Poston also introduced Clark to the latest research on medieval economies, which would play an important part in his thinking in later years. When the time came for Clark to embark on the 2-year archaeology honors curriculum, he had knowledge not only of prehistory but also of biological and social anthropology. Logically, he looked at the past by calling on a range of academic disciplines. This was an unusual approach. At the time, Cambridge archaeology was concerned almost entirely with Europe. But Clark did sit in on lectures by Leonard Woolley about the Ur burials, see Chapter 20, by Gertrude Catton Thompson on her findings at early farming villages in Egypt's Fayum, see Chapter 22, and by Gordon Child about Bronze Age Europe. At the time, many archaeologists assumed that prehistoric cultures developed in the same way everywhere, and so what was found in Europe would be repeated elsewhere. In 1928, Clark heard another British archaeologist, Dorothy Garrod, boldly informed the Prehistoric Society of East Anglia that this was not so. Their cherished European cultures were quite different from those of the Middle East. This was not a popular idea at a time when Stone Age archaeology centered on Europe. Clark absorbed all of this eagerly. He also spent long hours in Lewis Leakey's laboratory examining stone tools from Africa. See Chapter 29. The lectures and laboratory experience exposed him to archaeology far from home, to what was slowly becoming a global subject. Clark's Cambridge mentors encouraged him to study the Stone Age cultures of Britain from the end of the Ice Age to the arrival of farming. These were termed Mesolithic, Greek mesos, middle, and lithos, stone. A Middle Stone Age that was thought of as a transitional period before agriculture. Clark found himself looking at thousands of small flint arrowheads and razor-sharp stone barbs in museums and private collections. His dissertation was, inevitably, a dull study of tiny stone tools, most of them collected casually from the surface and not from occupation levels. However, his book The Mesolithic Age in Britain appeared in 1932 and established him as an authority on this obscure subject. As part of his research, Clark traveled extensively in Scandinavia, realizing that he needed to know what had happened on the other side of the North Sea. There, the record of Mesolithic cultures was much richer, thanks to sites preserved in waterlogged marshes. They yielded perishable finds, such as antler and bone spear points. There were even the remains of fish traps and nets from camps covered by shallow water. Clark also walked along beaches situated above the modern sea level, left by an earlier version of the Baltic Sea that had been far more extensive than it is today. This was a wake-up call, for it made him realize the magnitude of the changes that had affected Northern Europe immediately after the Ice Age. To understand human societies of the time, you often had to relate them to dramatic environmental change. The dissertation years were busy ones for Clark, who became increasingly impatient with amateur collectors obsessed with artifact trivia. Graham Clark did not hesitate to criticize the status quo. He and Stuart Piggott, another future great who was working at Avebury, were among a group of young rebels who engaged in animated discussions in college rooms. They became increasingly influential voices despite their youth. In a closing appendix to the Mesolithic Age in Britain, Clark pointed out the huge potential for environmental archaeology in the Fens, the marshy terrain close to Cambridge. This research would have to include botanists, geologists, and others, not just archaeologists. The finding of the Lehman and Ower Banks harpoon was one of the events that sent Clark's research in a new and exciting direction. The North Sea discovery inspired Clark and others to look for stratified Mesolithic sites in the peat levels of the East Anglian Fenlands. While working on his doctorate, Clark had become friends with botanists Harry and Margaret Godwin. The Godwins were students of Arthur Tansley, the founding figure of British ecology. Tansley recommended that they learn palynology, the science of pollen analysis. This method uses minute pollen grains in peat bogs to study major changes in vegetation since the Ice Age. It had been pioneered by Swedish botanist Lennart von Post during the First World War. The Godwins studied the peat attached to the Lehman and Ower Banks harpoon and showed that it was of the same period as identical weapons found in Denmark. They were ideal partners in Clark's new projects. The Godwins, Clark, and others formed a multidisciplinary research group, the Fenland Research Committee, in 1932. Clark was its most active member, starting work at a site buried under peat at Plantation Farm, 11 kilometers east-northeast of Ely. He found flints on a sandy ridge, then dug down to uncover a scattering of stone tools on what had once been a sandy island in a swamp. The excavation revealed a sequence of two peats, separated by fine sand formed by a higher sea level. The site extended from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age. In 1934, Clark and the Godwins excavated Peacock's Farm, another location close by. They sank a trench into peat and this time struck archaeological gold. A handful of Mesolithic flints lay below a layer with Stone Age pot fragments. Above this, Neolithic layer was early Bronze Age pottery. They had unearthed a rare stratified sequence that covered much of prehistoric times. With pollen samples and mollusks, the small group of researchers documented major environmental changes over time. This was the first effort at multidisciplinary environmental archaeology in Britain. In 1932, Clark became a fellow of Peterhouse College at Cambridge University, and soon afterwards an assistant lecturer in archaeology. He would remain at Cambridge for the rest of his life. From 1932 to 1935, his fellowship freed him from teaching. He used this time to travel extensively in Northern Europe, mostly by bicycle. There he learned to appreciate the great range of perishable artifacts made from wooden and other organic materials. He developed a major interest in waterlogged sites, believing that it was only a matter of time before one came to light in Britain. Clark's northern travels, during which he explored folk cultures, ethnography, archaeology, and environmental change, resulted in his second book, The Mesolithic Settlement of Northern Europe, published in 1936. In this brilliant volume, he pointed out that ancient societies had interacted with their environments. They could be thought of as part of much larger ecological systems. the elements of which interacted with one another. This was a radical idea at the time. The dominant themes of this superb book were ecological and environmental. If ever an archaeologist was single-minded, it was Graham Clark. He devoted himself totally to environmental archaeology, the study of people and their changing environments. He was also convinced that archaeology had a major role to play in society. Clark argued that the most important function of archaeology is to explain how ancient peoples lived. During the war years, Clark, who could not serve for medical reasons, wrote a series of articles on economic archaeology, the study of how people made their living in the past. In Prehistoric Europe, The Economic Basis, published in 1952, he brought these articles together into a series of essays on everything from ancient beekeeping to whale hunting. He combined archaeological evidence with traditional folk culture that still survived in Scandinavia, collected during his trips to Northern Europe. His economic and ecological perspectives became highly influential, even in the United States, where he himself was virtually unknown. Just as this important book was published, Clark was elected Disney Professor of Prehistoric Archaeology at Cambridge, at the time the leading professorship in prehistoric archaeology in the world. Clark had never abandoned his hope that a waterlogged Mesolithic site would come to light. In 1948, an amateur archaeologist reported a likely site at Star Car, near the North Sea in northeastern Yorkshire. Clark realized at once that the stone axes found on the surface resembled those from Scandinavia, and there was a strong likelihood that they came from waterlogged peat deposits. He excavated Star Car on a shoestring budget over three seasons between 1949 and 1951. The site, on the shores of a long, dried-up glacial lake, lay on a birch platform among reeds. A radiocarbon date of about 7500 BC provided a basic chronology. In his excavation report, Clark painted a picture of a tiny encampment set in a landscape of birch forest, where the inhabitants hunted red and roe deer. He described Star Car not just from tools and animal bones, but in the context of its surrounding environment, a first for Britain. 50 years later, teams of researchers with the latest high-technology methods re-excavated Star Car and found that it was actually a larger settlement than Clark had reported. AMS radiocarbon tests now date the site to between 9,000 and 8,500 BC. As Disney professor, Clark followed Dorothy Garrod, who had taught the first world prehistory course at Cambridge. He created a department that treated prehistory as a global subject, and he traveled widely, as far afield as Australia. Clark and his colleagues trained a generation of young archaeologists whom he encouraged to work overseas, often in little-known archaeological areas. I was one of them and went to Africa. His travels and the radiocarbon revolution resulted in one of his best-known works, World Prehistory. The book was unique in 1961. Other authors, such as Gordon Child, had written summaries of ancient Europe, of Maya civilization and North America's prehistoric past. But no one before had attempted a work that explored early human history in every corner of the world. World Prehistory ran to three editions and was widely read. Graham Clark was a shy, retiring figure who was nevertheless capable of harsh criticism of his fellow archaeologists. But his authoritative writings and his insistence on the importance of economic archaeology endured long after his death. Not only did he make this a central part of 20th century archaeology, but he also helped turn archaeology into the global discipline that it is today. Clark, like others who emerged later, rebelled against an obsessive concern with artifacts and chronological sequences. His writings influenced a generation, while his students worked, and some still do work, all over the world.